Okay, so today the topic will be consistency, stability, and convergence, as promised last time. These are very important concepts because they really touch at sort of the fundamental question in numerical analysis, namely whether essentially the discrete problem, the discretized problem, actually provides an approximation to the continuous problem that we are actually interested in. So just to write this down, the fundamental question that we want to address here is the following: does the solution or a solution to the discrete problem provide an approximation to the continuous problem? So essentially, putting this sort of in formulas, right? So what we want to understand is whether some solution U H, so the discretized problem, approaches the actual continuous solution U as this discretization parameter goes to zero. So for better and better discretization, do we actually recover the actual solution of the problem? And then obviously we have to specify some norm in which we assess that convergence. So this is what we will call convergence for some appropriate norm that needs to be specified, and then will depend essentially on the case. Okay, and so I mean, it's very obvious from this sort of question that what we really need to understand here is how does actually this discrete solution UH actually varies with respect to the discretization parameter H. So as we change the resolution, how does that solution actually change, and what are the properties in doing so? Okay, and so to sort of formalize this a little more, let me just define essentially the problem setting here. So just to formalize a little more what we mean by a numerical scheme and by essentially the discrete solution. So in the following, what we'll look at is are essentially numerical schemes that can be written in the following form. And I'll show you in a second that many, many numerical schemes can be somehow recast in that form. So this is actually a very general category. But to make things concrete and simple, let's assume the following form. And so we've seen this already last time when we discretized the advection equation, and you'll also see this on the third problem set now if you start to discretize, for example, the diffusion equation. So many schemes can be written in the following form, where you have some state vector on the left-hand side that refers to the new time step, tn plus one, t equals tn plus one. And you can write this as resulting from some update operator g applied to the state vector at the previous time step tn. So this here could be some column vector that we call sort of the state vector, and that would contain sufficient unknowns. And the unknowns are essentially the values of the function to be found at all, at essentially all the grid points. And you've seen that I've written this here in the first order in time fashion. And we'll see how that actually arises from other schemes that are, that actually involve multiple time levels. But in general, by you can recast the system in such a way that you'll find this first order in time form. Now this thing G here, as I mentioned, is what we call the update operator, and it can be, in general, actually polynomial in these other operators, S plus and S minus, which I'll define in a second. So these S plus and S minus operators are defined in the following way, so that if I apply S plus to say U at grid point I, I'll advance it to the next grid point UI plus one. And in an analogous way, as minus would translate UI to UI minus one. Okay, so that's straightforward. So in a sense, if you see here, the update operator G advances a state vector from one time step to the next, while it's a polynomial in other operators, S plus, S minus, which advance the solution at a given time step from sort of one spatial grid point to the next. And this essentially defines a large class of schemes. So for example, we can look at the advection equation that we discretized last time. So this will be our first example. So if you remember, we discretized the advection equation at the end of the last lecture. And we did so by using the following discretization scheme. So we had first order time and space. So let me just put this here again. So we were discussing a scheme of this form, and now we can make the following identifications, namely Q G of S plus S minus. If you look here at the right hand side, we have UIN appears once and then twice here. So we have one minus A times delta T over delta X times the identity matrix, or identity operator if you want, plus A delta T over delta X S minus. So we have one UI minus one over here. And so this is how we can write the previous scheme in the form that I just introduced above. Now, this is a very simple example. Schemes can be obviously more complex. So let's look at another case. Some schemes may involve multiple time levels. And you'll see one example on the problem set. For example, let's look at the wave equation here. It's just one other example. And let's look at the following discretization here, where we have both centered second order in time and space discretizations. So ui n plus 1 equals 2 ui n minus ui n minus 1 plus lambda squared ui plus 1 n minus 2 i n plus ui minus 1 n. Okay, so this is what we would call a three-level scheme. So we have three time levels involved here. So how to rewrite this in the form above? Well, we can introduce some auxiliary variables.
Sorry, Daniel, what's the lambda here?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. So lambda. Sorry, I should have written this down somewhere. So this is, this involves the speed of sound here, the wave speed c squared, and then we have delta t squared over delta x squared. So on the left-hand side here, we have the second derivative essentially with respect to time. And then here we have the second derivative with respect to space. So this is where the delta x and delta t comes in.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Okay. So we can introduce another set of variables v. I'm calling vi. Plus lambda squared, and then these are the terms, and let's say vi n plus 1 is defined as ui n. So what we can then essentially write down is the following sort of matrix or vector equation. Where we define sort of a new state vector u bar, n that is defined as all these components u1n, v1n, so containing all the values at all spatial grid points. And then, as you notice, we have reduced the number of time levels again to 2. So we only have time levels n plus 1 and n involved here. And so we can now write it exactly in a way as defined above. So this is how you can sort of deal with multi-level schemes.
Daniel, can I ask something? Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So I guess I would be tempted here to define my V as, you know, something, a finite difference version of U comma T. So as a velocity, as opposed to just a copy of the U variable, would there be, you know, advantages in doing it like this, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a sense, I guess you can. I guess you could do something like that. It would simply be a different discretization scheme of the equations. So you could replace essentially the velocity with a new variable, and then it depends on how you would discretize that. So that would determine how many time levels you end up with in the end. So that's possible. So I guess in the end, it depends really on how you exactly discretize the derivatives and how many time levels you involve. So because also if you would introduce the velocity as a new variable, you could still end up with three time levels depending on how you discretize.
This example, I would just have taken V to be UIN minus UIN minus one.
Okay.
So it would almost be the same definition, except that I would lose the factor of two in your equation for UIN plus one. But, with respect to what you said last week, I think the devil is in the details, and whether you do it like this or like what I'm suggesting would all have to be, justified by the stability analysis.
So. Exactly. So you would then go and do a stability analysis and see whether that scheme is actually stable and consistent. And then assess whether it would actually be convergent, which is what we're going to do. The devil is definitely in the details, and in exactly choosing the right combinations and sort of the right discretizations to end up with something that's actually useful in practice.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Any other questions? So if not, the third example I just wanted to mention real quick is implicit schemes. So one of which you will encounter on the new problem set to learn a little bit about this. And so they are typically of the following form. Essentially, one can write them down as some matrix, again, or say some operator, again, that involves these S plus S1 operators. And so here, simply the difference with implicit schemes is that they couple sort of values of your function u at the advanced time level n plus one. So they couple different spatial points there. So this is what essentially this matrix L is about, essentially. And so you have to essentially invert this this matrix to solve the system. This is what you can do, and again, you end up again with a scheme that looks essentially explicit in the rough context. So, if you just multiply this with the inverse L minus one, again, you end up with something that looks like this, which you can define as your new update operator G. UN. Anyways, that's something you'll encounter on the problem set. So this is just another side remark. So also implicit schemes fall under this sort of broad category that, that we defined above. Okay, so with these notes, let's actually discuss some of these concepts. So let's define stability here. So in this above setting of the scheme, let's say that we have some finite time t fixed. And then we call numerical scheme stable with respect to the norm and really this is essentially a placeholder for any norm you would want to look at. If there exists constants, some constant C that may still depend on the time you look at, then some constant beta and tau, such that the following holds, so that we can essentially write the norm at the of the state vector at time tn in the following way, so that we have following inequality, some constant. We allow some exponential growth here. Because the solution itself may be an exponential, for example. But we only allow exponential growth in a controlled way, so that we have some global constants beta and C that we actually know. So here we're looking at t equal tn, which is n times delta t. And so tau is just essentially a limit on our time step. So we're just saying that essentially if we choose our discretization in time small enough, at some point we should get into this regime where we have such an inequality essentially holds. So with stability, really, we just mean that at most the solution is allowed to exponentially grow in a predictable way. Now the other important definition is that of consistency. So again, in the setting, the numerical scheme is said to be consistent. Of order Q and P. Again, with respect to a certain norm. For any exact solution of the continuous problem, of the PDE, we have the following. And this is what is usually called the local truncation error, or in a slightly different version, also the so-called one-step error. So this is essentially comparing, plugging in the exact solution into the PDE and advancing it with a numerical scheme and then comparing the two results. So we can take the exact solution and evaluate it at the advanced time step t n plus one, and then compare it to the numerically evolved version at time step from time step tn to tn plus one. So the update operator acting on the exact solution now, evaluated at tn, and if that is a function that scales as delta t to the power of q and delta x to the power of p, that's what we call consistent of order q and p, where q refers to the consistency in time and p in space. So tau is called the local truncation error here, and local really because it's local in time. We're comparing this, so I could actually indicate here, should indicate this here by just putting an n up here, because it really compares two given time steps to each other. Okay, and now finally, the third definition that's important in this context, and then we'll put all of them in context. Is what it means for a scheme to be convergent. Again, with this above setting, the scheme is said to be convergent. Of order Q and P, again, referring to time and space, to the norm if for any exact solution to the continuous problem the following holds. So this is now what we would call the global error, in contrast to the local truncation error. So this is comparing the exact solution at one time step to the actual numerical solution that we have advanced from some initial data up to that time step tn. And so at this time step tn, we just look at the essentially accumulated error over that evolution time by comparing the numerical solution to the exact one. And we call the scheme to be convergent of order q and p if that error function can be written as something that scales with delta t to the power of q and delta x to the power of p. And that for all n, we could also restrict it to sort of to all n up to a given n, that it would just be the same thing. So this En is sort of loosely speaking Vn minus UN is what is often called the global error. Okay, so these are essentially three basic definitions. And now let's put them in context. So there's a famous theorem that some of you may have heard of already. It's the so-called Lux theorem that essentially tells us when to expect convergence and sort of brings these definitions in context. So that's actually from 1956, where it was first discussed by Lux and Richtmeier. So for those of you who are interested, can actually look it up. Communications in Pure and Applied Mathematics. With a single digit volume number. And so the statement is the following. So in the setting with the above definitions, and if we assume that we have a linear scheme, and so we're solving a linear equation, so that's a crucial assumption because it turns out this the theorem is doesn't hold true for nonlinear systems, and then sort of other things have to be considered. But for linear systems, that's a very sort of important result. So the statement here is that essentially if a scheme is stable and consistent of order Q and P, then and also if the initial data is sort of approximately is sort of consistently approximated, then the scheme is actually convergent. Stability and consistency is sufficient for a scheme to converge. And that's actually very important for numerical simulations, because sometimes, and most often, in fact, you don't know what the actual solution is to a problem, what the actual exact solution to the continuous problem is. And so you can actually not assess convergence because according to the definitions, right, we have to compare the numerical solution to the exact solution. But if we don't know that, that is actually a big problem. So how do we actually trust our results of the numerical simulation? How do we actually, how do we make sure that what we find actually makes sense? And so this is where this Lux theorem really comes in, that tells us that the only thing essentially we need to make sure is that the scheme is stable and that it's consistent, and then it will be convergent and lead us to the correct result. So this is why it's very important in the numerical context. So let's just write this down. Stable and consistent. Of say some order Q and P, and the initial data are approximated consistently as well, by which we just mean that the initial discretization operation applied to the initial data that we start with is of the same order. So it has to be also accurate to delta x to the power of p. So this is really what we mean by that. So the initial discretization has to be consistent with the discretizations that we do during evolution. So that's a reasonable demand. Then the scheme is also convergent. Of the same order, Q and P. So in other words, the numerical solution UN will approach the exact solution as delta T power of Q and with spatial accuracy P. And also for all times smaller than whatever we have as our stability bound. And here V is again our exact solution to the PDE. Okay, any questions so far?
I have one.
Sure.
So I guess I'm a little surprised by the theorem, because when I look at the statement of the stability criterion, I mean, to me, it looks very weak, because if I have a solution that's bounded or, you know, doesn't grow and the stability criterion allows for exponential growth, I'm thinking that this is, you know, a very weak statement of stability. And if I had a numerical scheme that gives me exponential growth when the solution is supposed to stay bounded, I would think that we're very, I mean, that this is a really bad numerical scheme, and I would expect that it wouldn't converge. But the theorem seems to imply that even if you had that exponential growth, it would converge. So I'm, it seems a little strange to me.
Yes. Yes, you're right. So I'll actually show this in a second. So I'll just go through the proof real quick, because it's actually fairly short one. And so we can actually prove that that's correct. But I agree intuitively. At least the way that we define stability here is a fairly loose one. And sometimes this is actually sharpened. And you don't allow for exponential growth, for example. And in those cases, it's even easier to show the theorem. But it turns out you can relax it to allow for exponential growth, and it still holds. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Any more questions? I mean, so far it's essentially just definitions and. So a little technical, but the consequences of the theorem are actually quite important for, you know, practical numerical simulations, as I just mentioned. In the nonlinear case, it becomes more complicated and the theorem doesn't hold anymore. So, but there are other theorems in place. I mean, at least the theorem would hold essentially in a linearized version of your equations, and you can make it essentially. A necessary condition for convergence, but it turns out there is also there are sort of also other theorems in place for nonlinear equations. At least in one spatial dimension, you can get some sufficient conditions for stability and convergence. It becomes more difficult in more spatial dimensions where such general theorems are actually not available. But at least in 1D, you can also get fairly strong statements on stability and convergence, also for nonlinear equations. Okay, so since it's actually sort of a fundamental theorem, and since the proof is not very difficult and long to show, so let me just go through it fairly quickly. So again, let's say we are up to some finite time, capital T. We know the scheme is stable and consistent. So from stability, we get the following, so that we can essentially write the norm of our state vector at time n. The n as the update operator gn applied applied to our initial data u n times to get to time tn. And so according to the definition of stability, that is again some constant, we allow for this exponential growth. And so here we have the norm of our initial data. So in other words, so far this is just the definition, and from this we can deduce that essentially the operator norm of this update operator essentially respects this inequality here. Now from consistency, we have the following. So our exact solution Vn minus the exact solution advanced by from the previous time step will have some so will give rise to some truncation error, so some rest term that I just call R here. So this rest term will have some behavior of delta x to the power of p and delta t to the power of q. So that was the definition of consistency. And so now we can look at the global error, which is exactly the quantity we want to look at for assessing convergence. So that was again En, which is the numerical solution compared to the exact solution. And so we can write this using our update operator. Plus adding here the truncation error, the local truncation error for the term involving Vn. So now since G is linear, we're looking at a linear problem here. We have G, let me just write this as En minus one. So we can just bring G in front, and we have our error at time step N minus one. We still keep, so this should be a minus here. We still keep our truncation error here. And so we can play the same game multiple times. So recursively just re-expressed as in terms of the previous time step, we'll acquire here another local truncation error. And so we can play this game n times. And so we end up with this expression here. Just have this rest term essentially propagated n minus one times. Now, the consistency of the initial data now tells us that the first term should be of order delta x to the power of p, because we've consistently discretized that one. So this norm of E0 is some function of order delta x to the power of p. And so we can write En as this rest term j equals 0 to n minus 1, and then the update operator acting on this truncation error plus this term delta x to power of p. And so just massaging this first term a little bit, so we can pull this out and then just end up here with DJ, and I can actually fill in. So we've already actually estimated this one. So it's exactly this expression up here for how the norm of this update operator will evolve over time. So it can grow at most exponentially. So let's actually fill this in here already. So this would be C of t, and then e to the beta j delta t over capital T, again plus the initial truncation error. And so by definition of consistency, we know that this term this rest term is of order delta x to the power of p and delta t to the power of q. So we can, so this is just delta t, and then if we just, you know, do the sum, we can just essentially sum up all these terms. So we have just n times this value. So we can, let me just, so this is more like equal, and then we have r here, and then we have delta t, and then we have just n times this term. Okay, so this is t by definition, so some finite time t, and so we know how this term scales, so this will in effect scale as O delta x power of p and delta x delta t power of q. And this is exactly the definition of convergence of order delta t power of q and delta x to power of p. So this is exactly what we wanted to show. So if I just scroll up here, this is exactly what we wanted to show. Oops. So this part here. Okay, any questions so far?
Yeah, I have a tiny question. I don't think it's very very important, but when we're playing this game of like getting, we're going from the applying G one time to applying it N times, the different rests that we're going to get are technically different, right? The only thing that we know is that the order is the same, but technically they're different R's. But we can yes. get away with this. Just say, no, I'll take the bigger one of them, and then I can anyway just like do what you did.
Or... Yes. Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, exactly. So you would just take the maximum of those. So if they differ, you just take the maximum of all these time steps. So these are n time steps, so finite amount of time steps, and you just take the maximum of those.
Yep. Okay, good. Thank you.
I was just going to say that I'm no longer surprised because the exponential is carried out. So it's true that the thing is order delta x to the p, but there's a coefficient in front that grows exponentially in time.
Right.
Right. So if you're happy with that definition of convergence, then I'm fine with the theorem. But I guess for a practical application, you may not be happy with exponential growth of your error term, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So sometimes you have to sort of make more strict requirements, essentially, on your scheme, depending on what you're interested in and depending on what the equations do. And yeah.
Right.
Okay. So it turns out that actually the converse is also true, so this is why it's also sometimes called equivalence theorem. So the Lux equivalence theorem, but so there's sort of more work to required to show this, and so we won't do it here. But in principle, this holds. Again, also for practical purposes, it will not be important because. From the sort of numerical point of view, from the practical point of view, we'll always use the theorem in this sort of one-way fashion that we showed, because the problem really is that we most often, and this is exactly what motivates the numerical approach in the first place, right? That we simply don't know the exact solution to the equation, and so we don't a priori know whether the numerical solution we found actually. Constitutes an approximation to that continuous problem, and so by showing consistency and stability, we'll infer convergence. So this is the direction in which we would usually use that theorem. Okay. Don't need to write this down again. Okay, so that essentially concludes the proof of this statement. So this is that's sort of conceptually important. Now the question is, in such a practical setting, how can we actually show that something is stable? So we should kind of shift the problem now to making sure that a scheme is stable. And so this is also. Not entirely trivial sometimes, and for some schemes. So what we would like to have is some sort of sufficient criterion for a system to be stable. So a sufficient criterion that we can check given some numerical scheme, sort of that sufficient criterion tells us, okay, this scheme is stable. So we can use the Lux theorem and be sure that we will actually get a convergent result in the end. So this is the next part I wanted to discuss. So how can we actually analyze the numerical scheme and assess that it's actually stable. And it will also lead us to another important concept, the so-called CFL condition. That will be next time. So for now, we'll focus on stability. So again, the problem is how to tell a scheme actually converges. So the idea is that we can infer, we can use the Lux theorem. So consistency and stability is most often easier to show, obviously. But what we want is a sufficient criterion for stability. And so this is another sort of important theorem, numerical analysis, the von Neumann stability condition. And so here the statement is that, again, we have a finite differencing scheme. Of the form that we've looked at. And this scheme is stable with respect. And this is a particular statement about the L2 norm. If and only if we can essentially, if we have an inequality for this amplification factor, so for this update operator, because obviously, as we've seen, the update operator, the norm of the update operator can grow at most exponentially. So we have to have some inequality for this. This theorem here is actually translating this into the Fourier domain, because essentially the interesting observation is that while the finite differencing schemes always couple values at different grid points, spatial grid points, for linear schemes in Fourier space, all these values decouple, and you can actually look at this amplification factor in a very simple way, and this is exactly what this theorem is about. Let me just finish the statement here. So we essentially allow this amplification factor to be at most one plus sort of a tiny part. And again, we have to be in this, what we usually call a convergent regime. So delta T has to be small enough. So smaller than some value tau for at which this starts to hold. So here G is amplification factor sometimes also called the symbol of the update operator G. And it's defined in the following way. And so this definition will become more clear in a few minutes, where you'll see why that makes sense. So here, by the way, I is the imaginary unit just to make things even more confusing. Let me just start sort of proving the statement, because I think a few things will become clear along the way. I will not prove essentially both directions. I will only prove the first direction, which is the sort of easy one and the most relevant one for us. If you're interested in sort of more details, you can look it up. I actually put the full proof into the notes. But I think it's not important to go through both directions. So the first one is as sort of more straightforward and easier one to do. So as I said, we'll sort of Fourier transforming the problem, and then things will become a little easier. So the discrete Fourier transform of our numerical grid function uj, where j labels, so here j labels essentially all our spatial grid points. And we can write down the Fourier transform of this . So again, here, to make things more confusing, this is again our imaginary unit. And then psi is between 0 and 2 pi. So this would be our Fourier transform of the grid function. And now we can observe that in Fourier space, it's actually very easy to apply this grid operator as plus and minus. So if we transform this, for example, so by definition, we have this. And so by definition of this update operator, will get u at grid point j plus 1. And so we can now simply relabel indices here. So let's say we define a new index L as j plus 1. You can write this sum as a sum over L, u L e to the I, and then L minus 1. Psi. And so we'll see that applying this update operator just provides us with a factor of e to the minus I psi. So it will just be e to the minus I psi, and then the Fourier transform of u of psi. So in Fourier space, we just get a factor of e to the minus I psi in front. And similarly, if we were to apply the operator into the other direction to go to j minus 1, we Fourier transform this, we get e to the I psi. And so this is why our scheme can be written sort of in Fourier space. Our scheme can be written in the following way. So plugging in the sort of definitions here, essentially for S plus and S minus in Fourier space. And this is the exactly what leads to this definition of the symbol small g of Xi for our update operator. So this is the nice property here in Fourier space. Things decouple, and we just need to multiply the solution at one wave vector with some amplification factor g of Xi to get the Fourier mode at the next time step.
Daniel, what happened to the zeroth index?
Say again?
L. When you relabel JSL, you lose information about one of the indices, like L equals zero or something.
Oh, okay, but that is probably the constant mode. Let me see. Yes, I mean, these are periodic anyways, right? So you just shift everything by one, and then essentially the wave vector at 2 pi will be zero, and vice versa. So that's that should be fine. Does that make sense?
Is this like the zeroth mode that averages that because your periodic goes to zero?
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so let me just denote this here by star because I'll refer to this equation again. So now the discrete norms here are the following. So this would be the discrete L2 norm in real space. And then the Fourier in sort of Fourier transformed Fourier space, we have this as our again, and here 2 pi is because of periodicity CT. So these are our essentially the explicit expressions for our two norms. And now you'll see why this theorem only holds in this L2 norm, because it turns out due to the so-called Parseval property, you can express the L2 norm in Fourier space with you can directly relate the L2 norm in Fourier space with the one, the corresponding one in real space, and vice versa. But that only holds for these L2 norms. And so this is why also the theorem only holds if you look at stability and convergence and so on in this particular norm. So let's just do this sort of little exercise. So this L2 norm in Fourier space, by definition, is given by this expression. And so let's plug in the definition of the Fourier transform here. Oops. So now we can actually move these absolute values into the sum. So this Eij, these Fourier modes are orthonormal or orthogonal. And orthonormal, actually. So this is why we can massage this a little bit here. We get uj e to the ij psi squared d psi. Now the norm, obviously, so this is one, right? So what we'll find here is 2 pi and then simply the sum over uj squared d xi. And that just is 2 pi times the sum, which doesn't depend on xi here. So this is exactly our spatial L2 norm. And so this is sort of just briefly rederiving this Parseval property that for these L2 norms, we can simply relate the Fourier norm to the one in real space. And so this is, so now with that at hand, we can essentially show this the statement of the theorem fairly simple way. So let's assume that this Fourier amplification factor G psi satisfies the stability property that was stated in the theorem, so that essentially it conserves the amplitude, so it doesn't, it only over amplifies by at most a tiny amount, alpha plus delta t. So it turns out that often usually sort of stricter requirements are again put in place, and this amplification factor is only allowed to be one at most. But it turns out, again, one can relax that assumption a little bit and just allow this tiny sort of this tiny amplification above one. So again, to show stability, we have to somehow relate the norm of our state vector at some time n, or say, well, let's start here at n plus one, to the norm at of our initial data, and show that at most it has grown exponentially. And so the theorem here now makes this clever use of the fact that in Fourier space everything decouples, and you can relate the norm, the L2 norm in real space to the norm corresponding norm in Fourier space. So let's write this down. So this is just to be super clear, so this is our relating here the L2 norm to the corresponding one in Fourier space. Now using our version of our scheme in Fourier space up here, we can re-express this as delta x over 2 pi d xi. And so plugging in the assumption here about our amplification factor, find that's 1 plus alpha delta t 0 to 2 pi, and then this is exactly our free norm at time n. Oops. Oh, I'm sorry, there's I missed a square here. Okay, so now we can re-express again. We can again use this Parseval property and again re-express this in terms of the spatial L2 norm. So this is un 2 squared. And so that is obviously smaller than e to the alpha delta t squared. So again, recursively applying this idea, we end up with the finding that the L2 norm of the state vector at time n satisfies the following inequality, delta t to the power of 2n. So now recursive n times recursively applied, we'll have the L2 norm of the initial data on the right hand side. And so this means that this scheme is stable sort of according to our stability definition. And sort of for the other direction, I'll refer you to the notes. So I think it doesn't make sense to go through all the details. I just wanted to give you essentially a brief idea, some flavor of what this is about, because this von Neumann analysis is actually something that's been done very frequently, and you'll also do this on some of the problem sets. And so I thought it was just sort of interesting to and maybe important to get some basic idea of where that analysis is rooted in, essentially, and to just explicitly show a few things here. And also, in practice, it will turn out that only will only apply and only use this theorem again in this first direction that we've shown here.